Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. My guest today is Andres Rodriguez-Pose, Professor of Economic Geography at the London School of Economics. In a distinguished academic career, Andres has published hundreds of books, journal articles and working papers, and has at various times advised the European Commission, the European Investment Bank, the World Bank and the OECD on a variety of regional development issues. I'm not sure if you've advised the UK government, but we can come back to that in the conversation. Our discussion today is based around a paper that Andres recently published called The Revenge of the Places That Don't Matter and What to Do About It, which is a great title for a paper, by the way. We'll put a link up to that website. So I want to start, Andres, by asking you to just define this term, you know, places that don't matter, and then we'll get into a conversation about, you know, what that revenge was or is, and then what we might do about it from a policy response perspective. So when you say places that don't matter, give us a sense as to the places that you're thinking about and talking about.
Well, the places that don't matter are not really places that don't matter. They matter, and they matter a lot. Hmm. These are places that have been told for many years now that they haven't got a future, that they cannot do well in a globalized and integrated society, and that the best thing for them in order to prosper is to mainly allow their population to move somewhere else where there would be greater opportunities for them.
And the sort of places that you're observing this on an international basis, not just on a UK basis. Your observation is, you know, that this treatise, this idea, we see this in many places.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's increasingly a larger number of places. Mm. If I were to put an emphasis on the UK, the places that matter would be the dynamic centres in the southeast, places like London, places like Cambridge, places like Oxford.
Yeah.
The places that have been told that there has been a lot done for them, that there has been too much emphasis on regeneration with very little success, would be the equivalents of many areas in the north of England, going from Middlesbrough to Hull, or to places like Sheffield, to a lesser extent Birmingham and Liverpool.
And in the paper that you've written, and then some articles you've written around it, you talk about, you know, this revenge, as it were, and this sort of the sense of what's been happening in these places, not only in the UK, but actually you reference the US and France and Germany and other places. Just give us a sense as to what that revenge is for you when you're talking about that.
Well, the revenge of the places that don't matter is that many of these places that for decades have been told now that they don't matter, that they have seen significant economic decline, they have seen a lack of dynamism, they have become much more dependent on public transfers, have decided that that's not the future they want. They don't want to be told that they have to move, they don't want to be told that they need to become dependent. They are proud places that have had, in many cases, a glorious past, and have used the ballot box not just as a cry for help, but also to exercise this revenge, saying, we don't matter, and we're going down, we're not going to be the only ones going down. There's going to be collateral damage, and that collateral damage is going to be the places that matter, mm-hmm. and the elite that is telling us that we don't matter.
Yeah, and in your papers, and you have some fantastic maps that almost perfectly, not quite perfectly, but near perfect, match this political geography and some of the voting outcomes from a number of, whether it's Brexit in the UK or the American elections in 2016 in the US or the French election 2017, that sort of relationship between the political geography and the economic geography, just gives a sense as to what that is, what that looks like for you.
Well, it's clear that the rise of populism is taking place very much not driven by the traditional externalities that we were expecting. It's not driven by excessive congestion or by pollution. It's not driven, although these are externalities that matter, negative externalities that matter, by interpersonal inequality. The poorest people in London, and the richest people in London mainly voted to remain. It's the areas that have seen decline, not just since the inception of the crisis, but in many cases for more than two, three, four decades, that are the ones that have used the ballot box to say, enough is enough. This is very clear in the case of the UK. Mm. Lincolnshire, which has the biggest share of vote for Brexit, has been also the county that has had the lowest level of economic growth since the early 1990s. But when we talk about Brexit, we see it in the US. The Rust Belt, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, all outside the big cities and university towns, created the shift towards Donald Trump that won him the election. And if we take a look at the case of France, the vote for the National Front has been mainly located in medium, small cities and rural areas in the long-term declining areas of the northeast of France and northeast, eastern France and southeastern France. We have to bear in mind that when we look at the trajectory of French regions, this is very polarized. Over the last 24 years, there's only one region in France that has grown above the average, and that's the Île-de-France, that is the region of Paris. All other regions have had a below par trajectory, and in some cases where this vote for the National Front is concentrated, for example, Lorraine has been the worst performing region in Western Europe in the last 40 years.
And yet that's not a why. I mean, you make this point in different ways in the paper. This is unknown or unobserved amongst the mainstream, even amongst the fellow academics that were overwhelmingly or increasingly interested in issues around inequality. They were typically inequality between individuals or between generations, much less emphasis and focus on inequality or variation between localities, you know, the physical inequality.
Well, that's what I've been told for a long time. Yeah. I am, after all, a geographer. Yeah. For many years, I've been dedicating myself to inter-territorial inequalities, and I've been told by many of my fellow economists that it doesn't matter where people live, it's a question of you have to focus on people. And in fact, the biggest inequalities are not across regions, they're not across cities, they are within cities. Mm. London has got some of the biggest inequalities in the UK.
Yeah.
Philadelphia, Los Angeles, New York have seen the greatest income polarization. In fact, the poorest in New York are significantly poorer than the poorest in many parts of, let's say, Ohio, Wisconsin. Yeah. But these really poor are not setting the cities ablaze yet.
Yeah.
I mean, it might happen in the future.
Yeah.
But at the moment, the reaction is coming from a very unexpected source, which is very much people that have seen the places where they live decline for a long time.
Yeah.
They are reacting. And the curious thing is that the average voter for Trump in places like Ohio or Wisconsin is normally wealthier than the average voter of Clinton in those same places.
Yeah, so it's not the poorest of the poor in some respects. No. You know, it's those middle income, but they're living in or within areas or localities that are relatively and in absolute terms are declining.
Absolutely. These are people that very often lived until relatively recently proud lives with jobs that thought they had a future, that have lost their jobs, that have seen their cities decline, very often decline in population, that have seen their children move out in search for opportunities, and increasingly that have become dependent on transfers, and moreover have been told there's no future here.
Yeah, yeah.
We have tried everything. We have tried regeneration, we have tried subsidies, we have tried bringing in foreign direct investment, we have tried attracting inward investment from other parts of the country, and nothing has worked.
Yeah.
Your best chance is to move to where prosperity and where potential is in the big city.
Yeah. So we'll come on to those. I mean, I'm interested in your reflections as to whether those attempts have genuinely been attempts or whether we played at them and not done them with sufficient focus. But because, you know, you're a professor of economic geography, you know, this is a space where many people have written about and talk about cities. You know, Ed Glaser, you referred to, Moretti, Henry Overman, your colleague, LSE, you know, different, Ron Martin, you know, lots of work done in this sort of space. But you have a critique or offer a critique of some of the thinking around urban economics, new economic geography as to how it, just, can you just say a little bit more about why, you know, why we haven't really done the work in this area? Because you're critical of the theory as well as the practice, and you know, our listeners like to kind of get under the skin of these sorts of things. So just give us a sense as to what the issues are in relation to urban economics and the theory of it, and how we then conclude with, we can't do much about these sorts of places, we should only focus on people.
Regional urban economics has made significant progress over the last three decades,
yeah,
especially since the late 1980s, early 1990s.
Yeah.
First, we had the emergence of new economic geography led by Paul Krugman, with people like Masa Fujita and Tony Venables or Jack Tees making significant contributions. And it's very difficult to summarize such a complex and interesting theory in a few words, but it was mainly about the idea of agglomeration.
Yeah.
That there were bigger cities, concentration of people, concentration of firms, concentration of assets and endowments in particular places would generate significant positive externalities that would contribute to increases in productivity, increases in innovation, and as a result, greater growth and more jobs, greater levels of employment.
Yeah.
That was followed by the revival of urban economics, mainly led by Ed Glaser and Enrico Moretti, that is now extremely fashionable across the academic world and also very influential in policy circles, especially in the US.
Yeah.
And they added another dimension, although again it's difficult to summarize such a rich theory in a few words, which is mainly the idea of density.
Yeah.
That when you have a lot of key actors located in one place, there's a lot of interaction, and that interaction creates some sort of buzz, some sort of diffusion of knowledge, transfer of knowledge, that leads again to more innovation and greater productivity.
Yeah.
And as a result, what you have is that bigger cities and more dense cities are increasingly regarded as the future. The 21st century has been dubbed the century of the city.
Indeed.
And in many ways, big cities are doing great.
Yeah.
London has been doing significantly better than it did since the 1990s.
Yeah.
But it's not always the case.
No.
If we were going from big cities and highly dense cities, we would have the Latin American cities, Bogota, Mexico City, Lima, that are very large and extremely dense, would be doing or having the highest levels of growth.
Yeah.
Yet that is not the case.
No. Well, you make this point about, we see urbanization but not the growth effects from urban, particularly in some of those sorts of cities.
In many cases, what we see is a displacement of poverty.
Yeah.
If we're taking a look at what new economic geography and urban economics are saying, in most developed countries, we see that this rings generally true. In places like Europe, what we have is that countries with a higher average city size, with bigger cities and with a greater concentration, have tended to do better.
Right.
In most of the developing world, there's no evidence whatsoever of that. We have seen a massive growth of cities, but many of the larger cities are not performing better. In fact, they are performing worse than medium-sized cities, and in particular small cities, below the threshold of 500,000.
Yeah. And one of the critiques I hear constantly around, or consistently around, the agglomeration and urban economics and that is, you know, this is a North American typically a phenomenon, and when you come to, particularly to Western Europe, you see, you know, yes, London performs well above, you know, its own national average, but actually Manchester or Greater Manchester, Greater Birmingham, Greater Leeds, you know, they are around the average, but if not below that. And when you look across Western Europe, yes, you see some of this performance, but actually there are as many kind of biggish cities performing below the average as there are average, but above the average. Can you unpack a little bit of that and give us your sort of view on that?
Yes, absolutely. In the case of there are two dimensions. One's a geographical dimension and one's a time dimension.
Yeah.
Let's take, for example, the UK and compare it to Germany. In the UK, there has been an increasing concentration of economic dynamism in the southeast, in and around London, and very often spreading along the M5 corridor towards Reading, Oxford, Bristol, and all the way down to Bristol, and towards Cambridge, more than anywhere else. In the rest of the country, it's not that there's no lack of dynamism. Manchester, Leeds have done particularly well. Edinburgh has been also particularly dynamic.
Yeah.
But much of that, the activity has concentrated or has become centered in the southeast. But this is something that has happened relatively recently. In fact, if we take a look, and this many of the work by Ron Martin and his team highlights that London for quite a few decades was actually doing not very well and was growing below the average of the country. Between the late 1930s and the 1990s, the population of London was actually declining, or the inner core of London. Since the mid-1990s, the story has changed. The question is, for a country like the UK, is this always going to happen? Is there some sort of, let's say, natural law that London and the South East is always going to grow? Possibly, I would suspect that in the next few years, London would continue to do better than the UK. But with Brexit, and not even if we didn't have Brexit, who could guarantee that London would do that?
Yeah.
Let's go to another country which has done extremely well in Europe in recent years, which is Germany. In Germany, the biggest city, or the two biggest agglomerations, first the biggest, the capital, Berlin, and the rural area with a tradition of an industrial core, and with about 6 million people, have done not particularly well. Much of the growth has been concentrated down south, in relatively big cities such as Munich, Stuttgart, and Frankfurt, but a lot of medium and small-sized cities in those areas have done extremely well. And this is something that has reversed in the last 40, 50 years. Before, all the activity, the concentration of wealth was located in the center and the north of Germany. The south was an area with medium-sized firms, but with a high dependence on agriculture. Now is one of the, let's say, the high-tech workshops of the world. So once again, I am skeptical about this idea that there's a general natural law that bigger, denser cities are always going to do well. Sometimes size and density matters, but what is much more important is what is inside the city. What is your endowment, your human capital? And sometimes Zurich has got, despite having 500,000 people, a fantastic endowment of human capital. What is your capacity to innovate in terms of the skills that you have within firms, the outlook of firms, the quality of the managers there, the quality of the researchers that have been trained in local universities or you can attract from other parts of the world? The quality of the institutions. How good is your governance? How good are your leaders? How good is, how strong is your civil society? And this is something that can happen in big cities or can happen in relatively small cities. If you go to very large cities in many developing countries, they are large, they're dense, but they lack the human capital, the innovative capacity, and the right institutions.
And they're ungovernable in some, in many ways, institutional sense that they are just so very disparate and large that, you know, organising and governing. One of the many things I've enjoyed about your work is your constant emphasis and focus on this, the notion that institutions, in the Douglas North sense, but institutions matter, and how we organise ourselves really does have an influence over time, particularly over the longer run, in relation to economic development and economic growth. It's not simply enough to have, certain individual attributes or assets. It's the combination of and recombination of those assets that makes a difference. I think, that's, I don't know if you would, that always strikes me as one of the strong, parts of your analysis and your perspective.
If you, for example, in Nigeria, and you concentrate most of your activity, or in your biggest city, Lagos, which is growing and has been growing in terms of population very, very quickly, what you're are going to achieve is some effect from this concentration of population and higher density. But unless you reform the problem of graft, high levels of corruption, elites that gather all the rents at the expense of the population, you're going to end up with a subpar level of growth. What we're having in many African cities right now is jobless growth.
Yeah.
The population flocking to cities, trying to see that there's going to be increase in prosperity and they're going to spread, but they end up in slums. And in some cases, when we look at Latin America, for example, it's not that the slums are an initial stage for these people to move up the ladder. In places like Rosinha, in Sao Paulo, what we have seen is that in some cases, we have a fifth generation of the same family living in the slums. You'll have some that can use their talent, moving from the northeast of Brazil to the slum and then prospering in life by moving to the big cities. Mm. Unfortunately, that's not the case for the majority.
Yeah.
The majority move from very poor rural areas to poor urban areas, and they are stuck there in conditions in which very often they can fend for themselves in the same way or even worse than they did when they were living in rural areas.
Yeah, that's a significant issue. I want to come back to the point you made slightly earlier on, ask you to expand on it. You know, you said, you know, part of the narrative that these places, left behind places, places don't matter, you know, they're kind of referred to in different ways by, different bits of the policy world. You know, we've tried to take public sector jobs into those areas, for example, or we've invested into often shiny buildings, you know, new real estate in those buildings, or we've provided subsidies to firms, particularly large manufacturing firms, but not only manufacturing, to go be located in those firms, or which we tried in the UK, 50, 60 years ago, will constrain the growth of London as it was and Birmingham as it was then, in this sort of sense that development would, you know, pop up somewhere else in the country. I mean, we definitely tried those kind of things, but what's your observation or reflection on, you know, those sorts of approaches? Because then I want to get on to what you think we need to do next. What's the next iteration? But what's your take on, you know, our approaches to regional development policy, not only in the UK, I guess, but, you know, Europe is suffering from these problems and obviously has a big focus on the cohesion policy. Just your general reflections on the you know, where we've been so far.
Well, I think we have tried many things, and I'm not going to criticise the things we have done individually,
because
every single policy that has been attempted has had a lot of good theory and a lot of good practice behind it.
Yeah.
The problem is how it has been implemented.
Right.
We have been following fashion, following fads, and thinking that one thing that worked in one place could be easily transferred to a different place within the same country in a different part of the world where it could be adapted almost without any sort of problem. And very often we have ended up with policies that are highly imbalanced. Mm. For example, most of the emphasis of development policies in many parts of the world has been on infrastructure and the development of massive levels of infrastructure. And when you have a shortage of infrastructure individually works and can work very well.
Yeah.
The problem is when you address the main initial problems and infrastructure bottlenecks, and you have good enough infrastructure to achieve greater levels of development.
Yeah.
We see a clear case in, I am after all Spanish, in the Iberian Peninsula. In the case of Portugal, if you compare the endowment of motorways of Portugal relative to its GDP with the 15 original members of the European Union, the richest and more prosperous members of the European Union, Portugal today doesn't have 10% more in terms of infrastructural endowment. It doesn't have 20% more. It has three times more.
Wow.
300%. It's a fantastic for locals and tourists. Well, mainly for tourists.
They
go there, and when you land in Lisbon, the whole area is paved with motorways going everywhere.
Yeah.
At a certain level between going between Lisbon and Porto, you have three motorways in parallel. And the motorways are high quality.
Yeah.
The only problem is that the Portuguese don't take the motorways these days because they are toll motorways,
yes.
that can be maintained,
yeah.
and they have moved back to the pre-1989 national roads.
Yeah.
And despite all this investment, what we have is that Portugal hasn't done particularly well. Why? Because the policy was not integrated.
Yeah.
It focused too much on physical infrastructure. More than 70% of all the funding going there ended up in the development of physical infrastructure.
Yeah.
While at the same time, one third of the Portuguese 16-year-olds left high school without a degree.
Yeah.
So you have, on the one hand, fantastic infrastructure. On the other hand, you have had 2 decades of having one of the lowest levels of growth in Europe. But after all, I am Spanish. I'm not going to keep on blaming my neighbors.
No.
In Spain, we have done the same.
It's the same, yeah.
The same. It's, we all have the second best level of endowment in terms of motorways.
Yeah.
Spain has got the largest network in Europe, second in the world after China, in high-speed rail.
Yeah.
But it hasn't led to any sort of particular dynamism, mainly because the high-speed rail network that has been built does not break even taking it, just taking into account the maintenance costs.
Yeah.
If you discount the investment,
yeah.
not a single line today breaks even. The Madrid-Barcelona, third largest city in the European Union, Madrid, Barcelona, fifth largest agglomeration in the European Union, and it doesn't break even.
I'm not going to ask you necessarily to directly comment, but that kind of raises some questions about some of our ideas in the UK, right, about high-speed rail between certain cities and, you know, what the kind of effects that might be, I guess. You know, if you're looking at limited effects around Madrid and Barcelona, I mean, I'm always alive to this point about, you know, we often talk about places and say, you know, your big issues are on the education and skills, human capital side. Mm. Yes, you might have some infrastructure bottlenecks and questions, but they're of a second order in relation to other places.
Well, other, if I'm going to comment on high speed, I always ask the question to my students and especially to developers in other countries, what is the number of kilometers of miles of high speed rail that there are in the US? And the answer is zero.
Zero.
Why is it? Because when you make the numbers, it doesn't work. It doesn't mean you shouldn't do any sort of high-speed rail.
Yeah.
And it's important.
Yeah.
And possibly if you do it connecting Los Angeles and San Francisco, or you do it along the Atlantic Corridor between New York and Washington, D.C., it would make sense.
Yeah.
In fact, the connection between Tokyo, Nagoya, and Osaka, Kobe in Japan, the Shinkansen, is actually now highly profitable.
Yeah.
Having said that, you need to think and you need to actually calculate what are the costs and potential benefits in the future. And it might work that in some cases, high-speed rail is going to be needed.
Mm.
But what I find is that in many parts of Europe, I'm going back to the case of Spain, the policy has been to go towards prestige, glitzy projects.
Yeah. Why is that, Andre? I mean, well, because, you know, you've advised the Commission for, you know, for a long time. You know, regional development has been one of the cornerstones, actually, of the notion of the European Commission and the Union for such a very long time. Why has it been colonised and controlled, really, by this sort of infrastructure-led approach when, you know, to you, and I would hopefully conclude myself in that, you know, issues around human capital formation, entrepreneurship seem to be, you know, the fundamental challenges or questions that we, you know, we observe when we see so many places. And yet, you know, we go there and the shiny buildings and the nice new roads. And so how have we got ourselves into, or how did that situation come about?
One word, institutions. And I'll tell you why.
They're for good and for bad, right?
For infrastructure, there are several reasons why we, most policies for development tend to focus or end up focusing on infrastructure.
Yeah.
One is that there are economists, not very many, that would say that infrastructure is the best thing since sliced bread.
Yeah.
That it's much better to invest in infrastructure than in human capital or in innovation.
Yeah.
They are increasingly in a minority, but there's still arguments and theories that go in that direction.
Right.
However, that's not the main point. The main reasons why we invest so much in infrastructure are, on the one hand, political, and on the other hand, based on management reasons. What are the political? Infrastructure is normally popular. Everyone wants a better airport. Everyone wants a third runway,
yeah,
provided the planes don't fly over your head,
yeah,
in general.
Yeah.
It's highly visible and is not going to go anywhere.
Mm.
There you have barren land, and then you have a motorway, or you have a high-speed rail line, or you have an airport, and everyone can see it.
Yeah.
And in many parts of the world, what politicians do is, right before the elections, they just cut the tape and say, I declare this new airport inaugurated.
Yeah.
And it's also something that can be done in a relatively small period of time. Let's come in 4 years, you decide, I'm going to try to develop some sort of new infrastructure. 4 years later,
yeah,
unless there are serious problems, you will end up having it. When you invest in human capital, you train someone, and that person, 2 years later, their brains might have changed completely, but they look exactly the same.
Yeah.
And they may or may not stay.
Yeah.
If you're the places where they're from offer less opportunities, they might end up going somewhere. That might be a benefit for the region of origin in the medium and long,
yeah,
term,
yeah,
but in the short term, it has implications.
Yeah.
So decision makers clearly want to go for something that is visible, albeit short term, and let someone else in the future deal with the problem. And that happens much more often in places with poor institutions.
Yeah.
The Portuguese in Lisbon needlessly built a bridge across the River Tagus in Lisbon to make it the longest in Europe, just because it was the longest in Europe.
Yeah.
It didn't solve the problem of congestion of traffic between the north,
no,
and the south of Lisbon, which was a serious bottleneck. But it was a question of institutions,
yeah,
and it was supported by the population. Did that bridge lead to anything? No. The Spanish government for many years kept on saying, we're going to have the biggest high-speed rail network in the world, and we're going to connect every single provincial capital. Never mind that there's no demand,
yeah,
that all the studies say that this is not viable,
yeah,
and there's some provincial capitals that have got a population of 40,000.
Yeah.
With that level of traffic, what you need is just a basic service and reliable service of normal train.
Yeah.
And what you have to do very often, if you do the numbers, is focus on freight trains.
Absolutely.
Rather than high speed.
Yeah. How do we, because institutions matter, good institutions, you know, make good decisions by and large, you know, on average at least, or above average. How do we limit the number of bad decisions that institutions make, or how do we increase, you know, the capacity of our institutions? What's the latest thinking and practice and theory around institutional development?
Institutions they tend to linger, and
yeah,
different types of institutions, following Ron Martin, I don't normally use the words institutional structures, institutional arrangements.
Yeah.
Institutional structures, which are based on culture, they're based on religion, they're based on identity,
mm,
they're very difficult to change, and we don't want to change them.
Yeah.
What we can change is the institutional arrangements.
Right.
There's no culture, there's no religion that tell us that corruption is good, that the elites should take all the rents,
yeah,
that there should be groups, the insiders, that benefit while the outsiders are moved out. There's no, let's say, culture or religion or identity that tells us that we should free ride. How do we address those? Well, it's not easy, and we're struggling with that, but the best way is to strengthen civil society. And that comes through a combination of more education, better education for everyone in society,
yeah,
not just for the elite. And we have done in Western Europe significant achievements in recent decades, but there's a lot to be done.
Yeah.
And on top, improvements in government, which go from transparency. So Verafin is it's as simple as putting everything on the web for everyone to see.
Yeah.
And greater accountability.
Yeah.
More prosecution of corruption.
Mm-hmm.
Naming and shaming, that works, but also creating some incentives to prevent the elites or prevent individuals from pursuing this graft and benefits for themselves very often at the expense of society.
Yeah, and you've done obviously work across across the globe looking at these different issues. What's your sense of the capacity of subnational institutions and the degree to which they are, you know, they're operating in a more decentralized system, you know, whether it's a formally federal or not, degrees of autonomy, because obviously one of the discussions in the UK is a relatively centralized, particularly England, centralized system, you know, relatively weak institutions below the national level in England, you know, subnational. Obviously we're trying to do something about that. We see different systems in places like France and others, much more federalized, much more empowered, but is that important in the sense if we want to build up the capacity of our institutions alongside, you know, transparency, levels of education, awareness? Do we also need to give these institutions more powers and authority over the things that matter in their areas?
Well, we have to be careful about this.
Yeah.
Subnational governments can work extremely well when you have a good institutional framework and when there's demand for it.
Right.
In many parts of the world, decentralization is working and is working extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
You have good, efficient governments that are capable of delivering very efficient policies that address the specific needs of one part of the country that might be different from those of the rest of the country.
Yeah.
Having said that, very often decentralization is done top down with limited demand from below and to places where the institutional capacity is low and in the way of unfunded mandates. It has traditionally been done in periods of crisis by central governments that want to get rid of problems and transfer powers to subnational governments that are ill-prepared because they have been set up in haste.
Yeah.
And they transfer powers but not resources. So you have unfunded mandates.
Yeah.
So in the end, you end up with many local governments that do not perform in the way they should. So in order to do that, things have to go in parallel.
Yeah.
You have to improve institutional quality. You have to create or help channel the demand and genuine demand in many places for more efficient government that caters for the needs of the specific needs of specific parts of the country, and at the same time start transferring powers. In many parts of the world, as I said, in periods of crisis they have decided the solution is to decentralize.
Yeah.
But in most cases that has been an absolute disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about, for example, the case of Indonesia in 1999, there was a big bad decentralization that granted significant powers to districts, a large number of districts across the country.
Yeah.
In a country that has got a level of disparities that would be, depending on how you measure it, 7 to 12 times what we see in the UK.
Okay.
There you'll have, in some parts, local governments actually worked relatively well. In most of the cases, they worked disaster.
Yeah.
Places like Germany, good tradition of decentralization, high demand, high diversity in terms of population and traditions, high diversity in terms of identity, but very strong institutions. Local governments, in most cases, they are as efficient, if not more efficient, than the central government.
Yeah, yeah. What would be your observation on, you know, where we are in this sort of debate in the UK? Obviously, we've got an asymmetric devolution. Obviously, Scotland, Wales, on the one hand, you've got London, you know, big city, some degree of devolution, then we've got our metro mayors of, you know, half a dozen places.
Mm-hmm.
What's your observation, you know, I mean, what would be your observation or reflection on where we've got to or where we're going on that?
I'm just an observer, but I would say that in the UK, there's scope for greater devolution.
Yeah.
but it has to be done carefully and it has to be done well. I'm amazed at how little devolution there is in the UK, despite the fact that places like London have been autonomous for the best of 20 years.
Yeah.
In fact, when you take a look at, for example, the Mayor of London, has got massive legitimacy. After all, is the biggest constituency in the UK, but it's powerless in terms of capacity of actual powers and resources.
Yeah.
And that hasn't changed significantly since 1997, the late 1990s.
No.
So what we have is that situation in which an area of the country that could be autonomous and has got significant capacity to govern itself has got very few powers.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one.
Yeah.
In other parts of the country, what we're seeing is now transferring the creation of mayors.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good approach because there's demand for local mayors in big cities. Many of the urban problems need local solutions and a powerful mayor can provide it. But still, if we try it and it works, we shouldn't be shy and we should do it. It doesn't mean that we should have the same level of devolution throughout. An asymmetrical devolution can work. There can be parts that are devolved if there's demand and there's needs. Many cities can deal with that at this moment. Other parts can wait. And because there's no demand, it's not that they haven't got the need, but probably there's no demand, there's no interest, and there's no capacity at the local level.
Yeah.
Once that is achieved, I could see, and there would be no problem in having strong and powerful local governments across the whole of the UK.
I would hope so.
One of the problems I see, and I've seen, is that in the UK, there are pilots, then those pilots remain pilots for a long time, mainly because the central government doesn't want to let go, keeps the power, and then every single national government that comes, there's a change in government at the national level, they dismiss whatever was done before and they try something new completely.
Yeah.
So we are starting again, over and over again. I've been in this country for 23 years and I'd lost count of the number of experiments that have been done with one common denominator, that this is not real devolution. I said, we should be careful about devolving, but in many parts of the world, and especially in many parts of the UK, it can work.
It can work.
So if we do it, and we see in the pilot and in the initial stages that it can work, then we should devolve, really. Not just do some phony devolution and then just restart with something new because the winds of politics have changed.
Yeah. No, well, you're not surprised. I would completely agree with you on that. I want to turn to in the title of your paper, "The Revenge of the Places That Don't Matter," which we kind of talked about, and then in brackets you've got "and what to do about it." And I think some of the thoughts in that paper are also reflected in more detail in the work that you've done with some colleagues, Michael Storper, who's been on City Talks previously, and Simona Imerino, and it's in a paper called "Why Regional Development Matters for Europe's Economic Future." And you take us through the story about where we've been and where we are, and then you set out an advocate for an approach that I guess makes the best of what we've done in the past, but actually recognises that in the future, if we want different outcomes, and particularly if we want to deal with some of these inequality questions, we're probably going to need to do something, you know, different rather than just repeat the issues of the approaches of the past. And I think you call it place-sensitive spatial development. Is that mm-hmm. So can you just give us a sense as to what that is for you? And again, you know, you're drawn on theory as well as practice to kind of lay the ground rules and the grounding for that approach. And say a little bit about that.
Well, I'm going to start by, Andrew, if you allow me to, before I go into that, by saying that this is not about equity exclusively.
Okay. Yeah.
This is all about also efficiency.
Efficiency.
Many of the places that don't matter, they really matter.
Yeah.
And they matter because they got potential that is untapped. So the European Union as a whole, but every single individual country, is losing significant economic potential because we are increasingly having blinkers and looking at development in the big centers and the big cities.
Yeah.
But there's potential in most parts of the world, certainly in virtually every single part of Europe.
Yeah.
The problem is that sometimes it takes longer, you have to dig deeper, and it's more difficult to achieve it.
Yeah.
So this is about developing potential, because developing equity can be developed or can be achieved through other ways. What we have been doing across most of Europe is that we have given up on true development policies in favor of transfers and welfare.
Yeah.
The Italian state has for the last 50 years spent significant amounts of money in subsidizing the South, virtually to no avail, to make actually to destroy whatever economic fabric was there and to make the Southern society dependent on transfers. That has become a serious problem, as we have seen. The vote for the five-star movement is concentrated in the old geographical South.
Yeah.
So the approach that Michael Stolper, Simone Iannone and myself are proposing is one in which the main goal is to dynamize the economic potential that we have in many parts of Europe. To make sure that declining areas like parts of the north of England, like the northeastern France, or areas that have never, at least in the last 50 years, taken off, like the south of Italy, can make the most of their potential. This is called the place-sensitive development approach. It goes beyond the traditional people versus place-based development, because first, I don't think that was a real dichotomy. Every single development approach is people-based, and I'm saying place is place-based. If you do a people-based, or what people were calling people-based development approach, for the UK that meant putting the emphasis in London, so that was also place-based. Place-sensitive means that this has to be an approach that is seriously based on theoretical developments, seriously grounded in theory, but also evidence-based, looking at what has happened in the past, in the areas that we're going to intervene, looking at what's happening in other places and making the comparison. But it cannot be a free-for-all. It's not a pure place-based in that respect, in that everyone can write their letter to Santa Claus and achieve their biggest wishes, because that's not going to happen. You have to have some sort of strong guidelines, clear goals, and then apply them looking at the specific characteristics of every territory. And of course that means that you need to identify a number of groups of territories, cities and regions that share similar problems. So we don't go from one policy at the level of Britain or one policy at the European at the level of the European Union to, if we take the European Union, 260 different policies. We go to, let's say we need a policy for big cities, and not just big cities, but the most dynamic of those big cities, in order to make sure that they keep on growing and they keep us competitive vis-a-vis the rest of the world. We need a policy for areas that have been, are very poor, are lagging behind, very often in Central and Eastern Europe, but that in recent years have had significant levels of growth. Many parts of the Baltics, Poland, Slovakia, have been catching up relatively quickly and are doing great. In some cases with significant institutional change, like for example in the case of Estonia, that now ranks among the top countries in Europe, including the most developed, in terms of how efficient and how good its government is. You need a policy for regions in the south of Europe that have been benefiting for quite some time from national and European policies, very often to remain stuck at levels of development that barely exceed 75 to 80% of that of the European Union. And you need another type of policy for the regions that have seen significant decline over time. The north of England or Wallonia. Wallonia in 1945 was the richest region in the European Union. Now it's poorly governed in general. It has problems with basic endowments, and it's below, well below the average of the European Union in the lagging area. You need to group those regions and try to find solutions based on theory to say, what is it that these regions need and what can we do? Let me just put the, give you one example. I'm going to compare the policies that need to be done in the low-income regions of Central and Eastern Europe, but that have been grown up significantly over recent years, vis-a-vis what needs to be done in those regions of the south of Europe that are far richer still than many areas of Central and Eastern Europe, but have been stuck in a low-level development trap. In Central and Eastern Europe, all the Baltics, Eastern Poland, Slovakia, it still makes sense to go for more traditional structural policies. Investment in infrastructure, and very often physical infrastructure, because the endowments leave a lot to be desired.
Yeah.
You cannot grow in many parts of Romania with poor roads, with inefficient supply of electricity and supply of water, with problems of lack of access to the internet, and that needs to be done, but in comparison, in combination with investments in human capital,
yes. Yeah.
And some support for local firms, plus improvements in institutions.
Yeah.
In the south of Europe, by contrast, there's no shortage of infrastructure. As I mentioned before, there's an excess
yeah.
of infrastructure
yeah.
in many of those regions. Yet, these regions haven't grown. More investment in many of the traditional endowments that lead to economic growth would not make sense unless you improve the institutional quality.
Right.
You improve government, you improve governance, you develop civil society, and that includes significant investment in human capital and on the job training. So those would be essential factors for economic development there.
Yeah. And when you look across Europe and we begin to pick out places like London or Paris, Munich, you already mentioned, I guess places like Stockholm that are very close to what we would call the kind of technology frontier, they're high income cities, high income places. What's the sort of policy response to them in terms of maintaining their competitive position, not only, I guess, within Europe, but actually, all of those sorts of places are very globally orientated as well?
Yes. Well, I would say first, it's not just a question of size.
No.
You mentioned relatively big cities and prosperous cities,
yeah.
whether it's Stockholm or
yeah.
Munich or which is Stuttgart or Frankfurt.
Yeah.
These are dynamic cities
yeah.
and they need responses.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of competitive medium and small sized cities.
Yeah.
Thinking if you take, for example, Bavaria, which is a prosperous region, it's not just Munich and it's not just Nuremberg, it's a place like Ingolstadt,
yes.
Augsburg,
Eichstätt,
it's everywhere, it's Regensburg.
Yeah.
You start thinking, it's what sort of endowments do you have? And we need to keep those places dynamic.
Yeah.
We need to make sure that Europe is full of Bavarias, Europe is full of Londons, Europe is full of Stockholms and Gothenburgs.
Yeah.
But what do we need for those cities? We need to make sure that they maintain their edge. And in those cases, what we're seeing is that perhaps there's not that need to do that much. But we need to make sure that we have the right atmosphere for development to take place,
yeah.
for business to happen. We don't put spanners in the works,
yeah,
so
yeah,
it's happening
yeah.
in many, many countries, that we create the right institutions, or the right, let's say, educational institutions, to provide the graduates that would actually deliver that, or that we facilitate the attraction of those graduates. When we look at the Silicon Valley, yes, there's Stanford and there's Berkeley there, but most people in Silicon Valley, they come from all over the world.
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
If we prevent migration, especially migration
yeah.
of the highly qualified, then we're going to have a problem.
Yeah.
Why has London outstripped the growth of Paris, despite the fact that Paris has done relatively well? Because London, since the 1990s, and I've been one of the people that have benefited,
yeah.
has been an extremely open society
mm.
for migrants. It's ironic that in a country like the UK has been one of the biggest beneficiaries of the European Union, not through funding, but through free mobility.
Yeah.
And the combination of locals with migrants from the rest of the country, the people that have been trained at some of the best of universities in Europe and in the world, whether it is the universities in London, Oxford, Cambridge, or Sheffield, Leeds, Newcastle, Liverpool, Manchester, you name it, they converge to London, and they converge with a multitude of highly skilled French, Germans, Polish, North Americans, people from all over the world, and that creates what is known as an escalator city that gives opportunities for all.
Yeah.
This is not the case in Paris, or has been to a much less extent, in which there has been a glass ceiling for migrants.
Yes.
So the top tier has always been limited to French, and that has stifled innovation, productivity, and growth.
That's interesting. To a certain extent. Yeah.
Yet, what's going to happen to Brexit, and what is happening to a city like London, especially in the last years, since the changes in migration policy. By becoming a less welcoming city, that's going to have significant impacts in the development of London and in the rest of the country as well.
Well, you bring it to a close, but I wonder, you know, bringing back to where we started, Andrew, is it whether you think that the political reaction, the political revenge is, as you, you know, we were talking about earlier on, these places and the, you know, the people that live in them. Does that create a set of conditions where, you know, grappling with these, you know, fairly fundamental economic and development challenges that we observe in these sorts of places, that are they likely to be much more important, much more significant in, let's say, the European Union's thinking or the Commission's thinking, but also in other places? In a sense, the political response has now created a set of conditions which gives us a better chance, a better opportunity to deal with these issues, because some of them are many long run. I've heard this a lot about, you know, Brexit. One of the kind of reactions is, you know, Brexit has sort of put back on the table some of the challenges now that we have for the economic futures of, you know, many more places outside of London. And had we just voted to stay in, maybe those issues would have been known, but they would never have, you know, got much higher up the political consciousness. I don't know.
Well, I think,
is there a silver lining?
That's a silver lining. There's a tendency to go, especially decision making, on follow business as usual.
Yeah.
To do more or less the same what we have done in the past in slightly different ways, just tinkering at the margins. And that has been going on for too long.
Mm.
It has been going on in Britain, it has been going on, I would say, that probably the whereas this country saw significant revolutions in the 1980s with Margaret Thatcher and the 1990s with Tony Blair, since then there has been relatively little change. And that has created a polarization that has led us to where we are.
Mm.
We are.
Mm.
It's not exclusively a British problem.
No.
We've seen it across countries in the developed world. We've seen it before in many developing countries. We've seen it at the level of the European Union. Trying to think that this is going to disappear is wishful thinking. And we need to seriously think about all these problems, because these problems linked to polarization, to places being left behind, are going to affect not just the economy of our countries, they're going to affect their social structure, the social composition, they're going to affect their politics, they might lead, let's touch wood, it doesn't happen, to conflict.
Mm.
So it's not that solutions need to be found, they need to be, the problem needs to be put on the table, it needs to be discussed, solutions need to be found, and there's a need to build a consensus that we need to change our policies in a way that makes most of us comfortable. At the moment, in the UK, like in many parts of the world, there's no discussion.
Mm.
What we see is a massive polarization. It's the divided country. In the US, the East Coast talks to the West Coast, and the rest is flyover country. And no one talks to them. And they don't talk to the others.
Mm.
We need to rebuild that consensus as societies, as advanced societies, and try to find solutions to those problems, because otherwise, this division is going to lead to conflict.
My guest today has been Andres Rodriguez Posey. Andres, thank you very much for being
part of City Talks. Thank you
very much. Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.